with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, today is the 19th anniversary of the murder of Benjamin Linder by U.S.-backed paramilitaries in Nicaragua.
Rush Limbaugh was arrested again on drug charges.
Authorities around the nation are freaking out in anticipation of Monday's general strike by immigrant workers and their allies.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, close to 3,000, as of today, close to 3,000 American soldiers have been killed, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 38,661 civilians have been reported killed by U.S. military intervention in Iraq. In 2004, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 28, 2006. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Annalisa Hummel. Tonight's Portland Peaceful Response Rally in Pioneer Square, already underway, marks the anniversary of the deaths of Benjamin Linder, Sergio Hernandez, and Pablo Rosales, murdered by U.S.-backed contras on April 28, 1987. 19 years ago today, Benjamin and his two Nicaraguan co-workers were killed by a contra ambush as they were preparing to build a small hydroelectric plant. Marking this sad anniversary, Portland's rally tonight honors the work that Ben began in the remote countryside of northern Nicaragua and his commitment to solidarity and friendship with the people of the region and with people all over the world who have and are suffering from U.S. foreign policy. Ben Linder, a 27-year-old engineer from Portland, was the first U.S. citizen to be murdered in the Reagan administration's Contra War. Ben was a casualty of the U.S. government's first war on terrorism, says Ben's brother John Linder. KBOO's love goes out to Ben's family, gathered in Pioneer Square even as we speak. We encourage listeners to head downtown right now and participate in this special memorial event. Liam?
A proposed ballot initiative to allow limits on campaign contributions has been rejected by the Oregon Court of Appeals. The court ruled the proposal, known as Initiative Petition No. 8, was unconstitutional because it contained two distinct and unrelated changes to the Oregon Constitution, violating a requirement that each constitutional amendment shall be voted on separately. The decision reversed a lower court ruling that approved the initiative, which would have authorized enactment of limits or even a ban on campaign contributions and expenditures by individuals, corporations, labor unions, or other entities. Oregon has one of the most wide-open campaign finance systems in the country. It's one of only five states with no limits on campaign contributions, regardless of the source. The other states are Illinois, New Mexico, Utah, and Virginia.
An Islamic charity fighting the federal government over an eavesdropping program has filed another lawsuit. This one seeks the return of 155 cartons of religious pamphlets seized 2 years ago. The Al Haramain Islamic Foundation is an Oregon chapter of the defunct Saudi Arabian charity. It claims the government's refusal to release the documents violates the charity's First Amendment rights. In February 2004, the U.S. Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control seized the assets of Al Haramain, this pending an investigation into whether the charity had given money to organizations involved in so-called terrorist acts. In September 2004, Treasury officials designated Al Haramain a global terrorist organization. Al Haramain officials have denied any wrongdoing and say the charity simply operated a prayer house and distributed Islamic literature to prisoners.
This weekend, Amnesty International USA hosts its annual conference on human rights in Portland. All this week, the Cable Evening News featured human rights defenders and abuse survivors working locally in Portland. For today's broadcast, reporter Chris Andre spoke with the new executive director of Amnesty International USA, Larry Cox.
And when I work on the news and I look at the events around the world, I'm wondering, I want to ask you a little bit about this sort of phenomenon of strategic blindness, the way countries will not see human rights violations, torture and so forth, when it's in their interests for whatever geopolitical or financial, when it's in their interests to turn a blind eye and not see what's going on.
Well, that's a very old phenomenon. It's always been the case that governments will try to use human rights to attack their enemies, but will turn a blind eye when human rights violations are committed by their friends. What is more frightening to me, which is, I think, a new development, is the kind of open attempt to justify violations of human rights when the whole world can see that they've taken place. And here I'm referring particularly to the extremely damaging debate in the United States, where you had the U.S. government, particularly the president and the vice president, openly saying that the United States needed to be able to engage in torture or cruel and human degrading treatment if it thought it was necessary. And that is, as far as I can remember, unprecedented. Most governments that carry out torture are deeply ashamed of it. They hide it and they deny it. This was an attempt to justify it. And it gave serious strength to dictators and, I should add, terrorists around the world to have the United States of America, usually seen as a champion of human rights, at least portraying itself always as a champion of human rights, openly justifying human rights violations in the name of the war against terror. And that's an extremely serious problem, not just for the United States, but for the entire world.
So how has that changed the way Amnesty International operates, and how has that changed the work that you do?
Well, it certainly has forced us to be much more attentive to work in our own country. For years, people thought that human rights, and this is something which I'm not particularly proud of, people in the human rights movement thought of human rights as something which occurred primarily outside the borders of the United States. It was a foreign policy issue. It was for people that were interested in international affairs. Now we become much more aware, I should say painfully aware, that human rights violations are also occurring within the United States, carried out by the United States. And so there's a much greater balance in our work now between working on very serious situations which remain in many parts of the world, but also realizing the damage that's done to our work on those issues if we don't take on our own government and try to persuade our government that that human rights is not something which gets in the way of security. Human rights is the only way to have security. And if you violate human rights, you're not fighting terrorism, you're aiding terrorism. That's what we have to do now. And that has, I think, changed at least some of the focus of our work.
That was KBOO's Chris Andre talking with Larry Cox, executive director of Amnesty International. Four boys who attempted to burn a cross on the lawn of a racially mixed family's home 2 years ago are being sued in federal court in Spokane. The four boys pleaded guilty in 2004 to malicious harassment in Spokane County Juvenile Court. The four made a 4-foot-tall cross and carried it to the Elk area home of two Riverside High School classmates whose father is an American Indian. They soaked the cross with motor oil and tried to ignite it, but failed. Victim Dave Anderson contends in the lawsuit that their right to enjoy their property without intimidation was violated. The lawsuit also names the parents of the boys as defendants.
Oregon statewide average price for regular gas hit a new record high at $2.91 a gallon today. AAA says that's up 2.6 cents a gallon since yesterday. Portland's average price jumped to $2.87 a gallon. Salem went up about the same amount to $2.86. Eugene up to $2.96 a gallon. And Medford leapt upward 3.3 cents, also to $2.96. Vancouver, Washington reset its record high at $2.89 a gallon. The good news for the southern Oregon city of Medford is it remains nearly 11 cents off its record high of nearly $3.07 set in September of last year. All but Medford are record highs.
In national news today, Rush Limbaugh was arrested in Palm Beach, Florida on prescription drug charges. Limbaugh turned himself in to authorities on a warrant issued by the state attorney's office. The warrant was for fraud to conceal information to obtain prescriptions, officials said. The conservative radio commentator came into the jail at about 4 p.m. with his attorney Roy Black and bonded out an hour later on a $3,000 bail. Black said his client and authorities reached a settlement with the state attorney, allowing the charges to be dismissed in 18 months.
House Speaker Dennis Hastert, Republican of Illinois, was caught yesterday on film by a news cameraman getting out of a hydrogen alternative fueled automobile and boarding his SUV after holding a news conference at a local gas station in Washington to discuss the recent rise in gas prices. Hastert and other members of Congress drove off in the hydrogen-fueled cars, only to switch to their official cars to drive the few blocks back to the U.S. Capitol.
Monday's national mobilization in support of immigrant rights is billed by some organizers as a day without immigrants. In Houston, organizers urged workers to consult their employers if they choose not to go to work. From KPFT, Free Speech Radio News' Renee Feltz reports.
April 10th saw thousands of immigrants and their supporters pour into downtown Houston on a work day. In the days following the event, many workers found themselves without a job. Employers complained they hadn't been consulted by those that left and they lost business. And in Texas, a right-to-work state where people can be fired without cause, the employer's decision was final. Now, as immigrant organizers prepare for what some are calling Un Día Sin Inmigrantes, a day without immigrants, they're taking steps to make sure people know the risk they're taking if they choose to skip work in order to attend the rally. Organizer Maria Jimenez.
Well, we don't want anyone to lose their jobs, and we understand a lot of people need their jobs in order to survive. We are recommending that people ask for permission, and if they don't get it, it's an act of conscience of each individual who decides that they must be there with us.
And she adds, those that can't get permission to leave work and choose not to strike can still show their solidarity.
They can participate by not buying, by not selling, and they can also participate by putting a ribbon around their cars or their homes, a white ribbon, an American flag or a flag of their country.
Some employers, like Hazar Aruz, who owns a business that assists immigrants with processing their immigration applications, do plan to shut down in solidarity with the May 1st day of action.
Nobody's coming to work. We're not going to make any appointments for in immigration for Monday. I mean, they come for an appointment, we're not going to make it. We're not going to do it.
In Houston, several taqueria chains and a Latino-owned seafood chain may shut down on Monday to show support for immigrant rights. Organizers say even if most businesses choose to stay open, they feel the day will be a success simply because a choice had to be made. Again, Maria Jimenez.
They open or close, we've already made a dent in having people reflect the importance of immigrant workers and the need to continue to press Congress and the President for just immigration reform.
Labor organizers in Houston have not called for a general strike, but President of the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement, Angela Mejia, encourages workers to consider participating.
The unions would not ask anybody for a work stoppage because we have contracts and we have to honor those contracts. And our union brothers and sisters are going to be taking either a day off or a vacation day or something like that if they choose to support the rally.
From KPFT in Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
The world's largest meat producer is joining other meat packers in a temporary shutdown Monday because many workers plan to attend immigration rallies. Tyson Foods says it's not encouraging the participation, but it understands the May 1st protest sentiments and supports comprehensive immigration reform. With Congress debating immigration laws, immigrant organizations are asking people to skip work and avoid shopping Monday to show the economic power of immigrants. The country's second biggest beef processor, Cargill, is also giving workers off in Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, Illinois, Texas, and Colorado. At the same time, counter campaigns to keep illegal immigrants from getting government services are underway in Colorado and Minnesota.
A new Medicaid law requiring proof of citizenship goes into effect July 1st. The new law will require Medicaid recipients to produce their birth certificates, passports, or other documents to show that they are U.S. citizens. According to Charlie Norwood, Republican representative from Georgia and the law's principal author, requiring proof of citizenship will stop the theft of Medicaid benefits by illegal aliens. Critics say that the new law is misguided and will be very difficult for many people to comply with, particularly poor people, American Indians, and the elderly. Also affected could be those with mental illness, Alzheimer's disease, and nursing home residents. Critics fear that the new law will increase the number of uninsured and that 3 to 5 million low-income people already on Medicaid will find their coverage at risk.
Five Congress members were willingly arrested and led away from the Sudanese embassy in plastic handcuffs today in protest of the Sudanese government's role in atrocities in the Darfur region. Representative Tom Lantos, Democrat of California, a Holocaust survivor who founded the Congressional Human Rights Caucus, called for an end to the genocide from the embassy steps before his arrest. Four other Democratic Congress members, James McGovern and John Oliver of Massachusetts, Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, and Jim Moran of Virginia, were among 11 protesters arrested on charges of disorderly conduct and unlawful assembly, a misdemeanor subject to a fine. At the White House, President Bush met with Darfur advocates today and lent his support to rallies planned in more than a dozen cities around the country this weekend to protest the violence in that embattled western region of Sudan. Portland's Save Darfur rally is this Sunday, April 30th, at 1:30 in the afternoon at Pioneer Courthouse Square.
The United Nations World Food Program announced that due to lack of funds from donor governments, they will have to cut the food rations of 3 million people in the Darfur region of western Sudan by half in order to sustain limited food supplies through the rainy season. The UN's decision will be another blow to a region that has suffered a three-year-old military conflict that has left thousands dead and millions displaced. FSRN's Selina Musuta reports from the Sudanese embassy.
Never again, said Democratic Congressman Tom Lantos of California, a Holocaust survivor, minutes before Secret Service police placed him in plastic handcuffs.
This generation has watched the slaughter in Cambodia. This generation has watched the slaughter in Rwanda. We will not watch the slaughter in Darfur.
Lantos, along with his fellow representatives Jim Moran of Virginia, James McGovern and John Oliver of Massachusetts, and Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, were arrested on charges of disorderly conduct and unlawful assembly, which are misdemeanors. The protesters demanded that the Sudanese government accept UN peacekeeping forces in Darfur and allow humanitarian relief organizations full access to village and refugee camps in the region. Again, Lantos.
2 years ago, it was my pleasure to manage the legislation designating what is going on in Darfur a genocide. It is a genocide. And this genocide must stop.
The Sudanese government, which mounted aerial bombardment campaigns after non-Arab rebels complaining of discrimination attacked government installations in 2003, deny arming and supporting an Arab militia known as the Janjaweed. The Janjaweed has taken part in the mass killing, looting, and rapes of mostly non-Arab communities. Samia Usman Ishag, who is a Darfurian, works directly with women survivors of the conflict in the camps of Darfur. As farmers, women were active sources of income before the war. Now they are targets, says Ishag.
They have no source of income. The other alternatives they have, they make other challenges like rape and subjected to other harassment. They need protection. Protection has to come from the international community, from the United Nations in the world. They have to protect them, they have to support them with peacekeeping mission. Because if there is no peacekeeping mission, the African Union alone, they are not able to protect them because their mandate is very weak.
The 2006 Emergency Supplemental Appropriations Bill, making its way through the Senate, includes $50 million in peacekeeping funds to train and equip the African Union force in Darfur. The Senate is not expected to vote on the bill until next week. This Sunday, thousands in several cities across the country are expected to rally for the U.S. to place added pressure on the Sudanese government to stop the violence in Darfur. Selina Masuda, FSRN, in Washington, D.C.
It's 5:20. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Time for another report from the wide, 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 wild world of sports. Exciting news, sports fans. Marketers have made a trend-setting breakthrough for the corporate branding of sports. For some time, corporations have been plastering our stadiums with such lovable names as Office Depot Center, Bank of America Stadium, and Enron Field, until that corporation plunged into infamy and bankruptcy. Well, if you loved having a cool corporate ID slapped on your local stadium, get ready to be deliriously happy, for corporations have now begun to put their brands on the teams themselves. One of our listeners has labeled this development an act of brandalism. The first victim is the Major League Soccer team, formerly known as the Metro Stars. This New York City team was recently bought by the Austrian corporation that produces Red Bull, the energy drink and cocktail mixer. So, shazam, the Metro Stars are now the New York Red Bulls, and the players trot out for each match wearing jerseys bearing the corporate logo. As the team president gamely says, we are part of the Red Bull family. How sweet. But it's not a family. It's a corporation, and the team is just another commodity being peddled by the executives and bean counters back at headquarters. It's one thing to cheer for a team, but it's hard to connect with a corporate profit center. Go Red Bulls, raise your return on investment, downsize the workforce, hike your CEO's pay, score! One sports marketing executive scoffs at critics who are concerned that other corporations will follow the Red Bull example. Can you imagine the New York Rangers hockey team being called the ABC Rangers, he asks. This is Jim Hightower saying, sadly, yes. I can also imagine the Walmart Warriors, the Yahoo Yankees, or the ExxonMobil Cowboys. After all, we're talking about profit-grabbing corporations, not sports. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Bread and Roses. At 7, it's Jay's Place. Tonight's weather in the Willamette Valley, sunny and warm. Nighttime highs over 50 degrees. In the Columbia Gorge, partly cloudy and cooler. Tomorrow, rainy in Portland and Corvallis. Partly sunny in the Gorge, highs around 60 degrees. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver and Hood River.
The former head of the interrogation center at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq was charged today with cruelty, maltreatment, and other criminal offenses for his alleged involvement in the abuse of detainees in 2003. Lieutenant Colonel Stephen L. Jordan is the highest-ranking officer at Abu Ghraib to face criminal charges, although higher-ranking officers have been reprimanded and relieved of command.
And on the lighter side, there's a tempest in a top hat in Atlantic City. Civic leaders have launched a petition drive aimed at persuading the maker of Monopoly to keep the blue-collared boardwalk property in the corner spot when a new Here and Now version of the game debuts this summer. Hasbro is holding an online poll aimed at determining which cities go where on the board. The biggest vote getter would replace Boardwalk as the game's premier parcel. The new version will feature streets, neighborhoods, and national monuments from up to 22 U.S. cities instead of the properties in the original game. For 70 years, they've mirrored Atlantic City real estate. The standard Monopoly will still be sold. The Convention and Visitors Authority has added a Help Keep Atlantic City on the Board icon to its website. To vote, go to www.atlanticcitynj.com. That's the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 28, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland. in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Our assistant producer is Noah Eaton. Tonight's audio editor is Noah Eaton. And special thanks to reporters Kirsten Flagg, Jake Woolner, Lila Hamblin, and Chris Andre. Our engineer is Brian Averill. The KBU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBU, beginning at 7, it's a May Day special. A Day Without Immigrants, a 14-hour special on the nationwide strike and boycott for immigrant workers' rights. The day will include live coverage of the rally at Pioneer Courthouse Square, reports from radio stations throughout the country on actions and reactions, live music, poetry, panel discussions, and more. That's all day Monday, May 1st, from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. And Democracy Now! Listeners, listen up. Because of the special programming, Democracy Now! Will be heard at a different time than usual. It will be on at 9 a.m. That's Monday morning only. That's here on KBU. KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-owned community radio station. Jimi Hendrix said, "When the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace."
This KBU program has been made possible in part by KBU Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. Stay tuned for Counterspin, followed by Independent Native News. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, articles and posts are flying around the web with headlines like, "The End of the Internet." How serious is the threat of the disturbingly named Communications Opportunity Promotion and Enhancement Act, and what can you do about it? And how does that connect to the threat currently facing public access TV? We'll talk about both issues with Jeff Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy. Also on the show, when activists used to protest the World Bank and IMF, many in the mainstream media took the lazy way out, basically pointing and laughing at the blue-haired street-marching anarchists. Nowadays, coverage of the World Bank has a new problem, kid-glove treatment of its new boss, former Pentagon official Paul Wolfowitz. He's getting high marks from the press, but what do World Bank critics think? We'll speak to one, Anne Louise Colgan of the group Africa Action. That's coming up. But first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
It's hard to watch TV news for very long these days and not see something about soaring gas prices. Not that that something will necessarily be good reporting. Take the April 25th broadcast of ABC's World News Tonight. In one segment, reporter Martha Raddatz mentioned that George W. Bush is, quote, directing the EPA to ease environmental regulations on fuel requirements, close quote, and suggesting a rollback on some oil company tax breaks. As Raddatz explained, quote, "These are measures that Democrats and conservationists have been urging the president to take for a long time," close quote. Really? Environmental groups have been pushing for a rollback of environmental regulations? Viewers that were scratching their heads at that one might have been further confused by another segment that night, one ABC dubbed a reality check on rising prices. But the sources invited to unspin the issue were not exactly a diverse bunch. A former Reagan administration official turned energy industry analyst and an investment analyst. ABC's reporter Betsy Stark sounded skeptical about whether any of the White House's moves would have much impact, but she did think one offered some promise, getting rid of pesky environmental rules. As she put it, quote, "What could impact prices almost immediately is a suspension of environmental regulations. The reality here is that waiving the elaborate rules on summertime blends will likely push supplies up and prices down," close quote. While that would be news to the Bush administration, the Washington Post reported that the White House's top economist doesn't think it'll affect prices at all. It's more about, in the paper's words, quote, "making sure some stations do not run out of gasoline than lowering prices," close quote. ABC can out-White House the White House if they want, but reality check probably isn't the best name for it.
A May 1st Newsweek article about the staff shakeups at the White House included the currently popular notion that George W. Bush's low popularity numbers reflect not so much substantive dissent as the fact that the guy just can't catch a break, even when, in Newsweek's words, things go his way. Their example, the economy. Quote, "For the most part, economists say it's strong, and Bush should be enjoying the credit. Instead, polls show voters believe things are still sluggish, largely because gas prices are so high," close quote. But people aren't confused about the economy, as the magazine suggests, by gas prices or by the war in Iraq, as other outlets have had it, or by anything else. Large numbers of Americans don't think the economy is strong for the simple reason that for them it isn't. Yes, corporate profits are up and rich people are benefiting mightily from tax breaks and other favorable policies. But though corporate journalists can't seem to get it through their heads, this simply does not mean that everyone is doing better. In fact, wages and incomes for average workers are down in recent years. The poverty rate is increasing along with indebtedness. The article was headlined, "Bush Pops His Bubble," but out-of-touch formulations like that invite the question of whether journalists will ever manage to pop their own.
In high-profile sexual assault cases, lawyers sometimes selectively feed information to the media in the hopes of helping their client. The ethics of such tactics are dubious, but they can sway potential jurors or even pressure an accuser into dropping a case due to unwanted publicity. In the Kobe Bryant case, for instance, after a defense lawyer accidentally named the accuser repeatedly in court, the woman endured harassment and even death threats before eventually dropping charges. So when a 27-year-old dancer accused members of the Duke University lacrosse team of sexual assault recently, it should have come as no surprise that stories began leaking out to a press corps that was, to put it mildly, highly receptive. On April 21st, USA Today looked at that phenomenon in a story headlined, "Prosecutors' Defense Trying Their Case in Public." Well, you'd conclude from that headline that both sides were pretty much equally guilty of leaking. And the first few paragraphs would bolster that impression, describing how the lawyers were leaking information, quote, "aimed at casting either Duke lacrosse players or their alleged victim in an unfavorable light," close quote. But the actual evidence in the article shows something quite different. There is exactly one instance of prosecutorial leaking, and the rest of the piece documents the fairly aggressive leaking strategy of defense attorneys, releasing DNA tests, photos, receipts, and other records that purport to clear the players of wrongdoing. Once again, then, media seem to be stretching so hard to be balanced that they've sacrificed a more fundamental journalistic goal, accuracy.
With Chinese President Hu Jintao visiting the White House, there were any number of ways media could talk about China. But PBS NewsHour anchor Margaret Warner presented an April 20th panel on U.S.-China relations that included three people who see things through a business lens and one ideological conservative. The panelists were Kenneth Lieberthal, a political science and business administration professor, also Clinton-era National Security Council staffer, John Kasich of the Right Wing Heritage Foundation, Robert Hormats from Goldman Sachs, and Linda Lim, a professor of corporate strategy and international business at the University of Michigan Business School. The segment reduced U.S.-China relations to a discussion of business and economic issues coming strictly from the viewpoint of business and economic elites. So, while the U.S. trade deficit and currency issues were mulled over, no mention was made of the impact of policy on the citizens of either country, say, trade policies that have moved jobs out of the U.S. to cheaper labor markets, and the related issue of labor and human rights conditions in China, one of the world's cheapest labor markets due largely to poor pay and brutal working conditions. But then you can't have that sort of discussion if you don't invite guests who are likely to raise issues relating to human rights, labor, and the effects of economic policy on the general public. The panel was seemingly no fluke. A search of NewsHour transcripts over the last month shows there was no segment that focused on those issues. So it's worth asking yet again where the public interest is addressed on Public Broadcasting's NewsHour.
And finally, on April 23rd, CBS's 60 Minutes aired a tough report on intelligence manipulation by the White House in the run-up to the Iraq War. Viewers heard from a recently retired high-ranking CIA official who blew the whistle on the Bush administration's dishonesty over the so-called intelligence failure with regard to Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. 60 Minutes also reported on the still mysterious Niger forgeries, documents that the White House and British intelligence relied on to claim that Iraq was trying to import yellow cake uranium from the African nation. But wait a second, that last part might sound familiar. In fact, that story was supposed to air on CBS in the fall of 2004. What happened? Well, it was a case of bad timing. As a CBS spokesperson told the New York Times, quote, "It would be inappropriate to air the report so close to the presidential election," close quote. Translation, it would have made Bush look bad at the moment some citizens could have been deciding who to vote for in November. As Fair noted at the time, few media outlets took notice of this outrageous act of politically motivated censorship, nor did they connect the dots between that decision and the fact that at the very same time, the head of the CBS parent company Viacom was expressing his preference for having George W. Bush in the White House for another 4 years. But at least one question remains. Why is CBS comfortable with airing this story now? Perhaps the growing unpopularity of the war and the White House makes it safer to report on such unpleasant facts. And perhaps no one at CBS even asks themselves what would have happened if they had aired the segment in 2004, back when it would have really mattered.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. As critics who complain about the anti-democratic, exclusionary nature of corporate media, we at Counterspin often hear the question, but what about the Internet? Isn't it inherently a challenge to big media, a technological way to subvert their top-down bias? Experience suggests the answer is not without a fight. This isn't the first time a new media form has invited such hopes. Time was cable TV promised to be a community medium, with localism, low cost, and diversity as central tenets. In both instances, powerful corporate interests have battled with citizen activists and public interest groups over the shape and the purpose of the new media, with, sad to say, corporate interests generally winning the day. As we speak, both the Internet as we know it and community TV face serious threats in Congress. On the one hand, telephone companies moving into the business of providing Internet and video services are looking to rewrite the franchise agreements cable companies have traditionally made with local communities. On the other, telephone and cable companies are pushing to fundamentally change the way the Internet works, charging fees for use and giving preferred treatment to content providers with deeper pockets. Here to discuss these issues is Jeff Chester, Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jeff Chester.
Thank you.
Well, clearly these issues are related, but we're going to separate them for clarity's sake and talk first about the future of community or public access TV and this Barton-Rush bill. What is at stake here?
Well, the phone lobby, AT&T, which used to be SBC, and Verizon and their supporters are about to wreck community TV. They are using their clout to get the Congress over the next few weeks, unless we can defeat this bill, to eliminate the right of local communities to determine how cable television and indeed all broadband communication systems serve them. The phone companies don't want to negotiate with cities. They don't want to have to have a government agency, a local government authority, overseeing what they do, whether or not they treat everyone fairly. For example, the phone industry only really wants to provide these services to the wealthiest parts of town. AT&T and Verizon want to redline. They don't want to serve low or lower middle income households. They want to pump out tremendous profits that they believe they can garner from selling affluent consumers interactive media and video-on-demand services. So the phone industry has gone to Congress and has gone to state legislatures and is on the eve of getting Congress to, as I said, eliminate the right of cities to negotiate how the terms of cable service can be accomplished in the community.
Well, one of the things that has come out of the negotiations that cable companies make with local communities is, of course, public access television, those channels we're familiar with. Now, is this bill going to eliminate those public access channels? What's going on there?
Well, what this bill does is it eliminates the right of local communities, local governments and counties to negotiate with cable or phone companies when they either operate or want to operate cable service. I mean, it's very important to remember it's not just plain old cable anymore, that whatever wire passes through your streets, whether it's the phone or cable wire, is going to be delivering you multi-channel television, cable television. It's going to be delivering you voice services, telephone services, and also data services, access to the Internet. So there's much more at stake here than just who's your cable provider. Under the Barton-Rush legislation, the bill that's now before the House of Representatives, cities would continue to receive fees from companies, so-called franchise fees, and cities would also have access services available. But the access services would be frozen in time. These cities would be given just a few channels at a time when, if we were able to continue franchising, cities could demand and expect to receive from phone and cable companies a significant portion of the capacity of these very powerful wires. Imagine channels and all kinds of services hooking up schools to the Internet, serving low-income communities with low-cost or free Internet access, advanced systems for public safety. All of those services would be available if the cities had some authority to require the phone and cable giants to pay back the residents of a community, to have a kind of public interest quid pro quo. Sadly, we are about to lose that.
Well, we'll move on now to the other major issue. A recent article of yours in The Nation was headlined "The End of the Internet." I don't know that you chose that, but I'm guessing you don't think it's too much of a stretch. How would the changes that are currently on the table spell the end of the Internet as we've come to know it?
Well, my original title actually was "The Hijacking of the Internet."
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what's about to happen. The Internet's not going to go away, but its fundamental nature as an open, non-discriminatory, and more democratic medium is under threat. The phone and cable industries have been able to use their clout with the Bush administration to have the Republican Federal Communications Commission change the rules of the Internet road. Up until recently, the Internet was required by federal rules to be an open medium, to treat all content fairly. Your Internet service provider couldn't slow down your email or speed up access to a website if it favored it. Your Internet service provider couldn't, for example, cut off your access or slow down your access to a peace website. Well, the phone and cable industry saw an open Internet as a real threat to their monopolies over either television in the case of cable or the phone business in the case of Verizon and AT&T. So the phone and cable lobby went to the FCC, they changed the rules, and now they can determine the Internet's digital destiny. They now have the authority to make all kinds of business decisions about how the Internet in the United States operates. They plan to speed up the content that they own, and those who can afford to pay to have their content speeded up, they'll get preferential treatment. They could slow up competing content. They could block access to content. What the phone and cable companies want to do is, in their own words, monetize the Internet. They want to set up a series of virtual toll booths. If you want your content to come down fast, you're going to have to pay more. You know, if you want to put content online and make sure that content's available to all users, you're going to have to pay them huge fees. So the phone and cable industry's vision, really, for the future of this diverse digital medium is really rooted in cable television. They want to set up a system so that they can extract as much profit as possible and, in particular, make sure that the content they own or that the content backed either by Hollywood and Madison Avenue is in the fast lane and everybody else, including, frankly, the public interest, is in the slow digital dirt road.
Well, finally, in the brief amount of time we have left, it seems that industry always skates where the puck is going to be, as I've heard it called. They set up deals that they want, and then they basically help write the laws that make those deals legal. And it's hard to fault the public when we don't really know about what we're losing because we don't even know it's in play. How does the public stand a chance here in rolling back these actions?
Well, not just public interest groups, but some of our biggest new media giants are also alarmed by what the phone and cable industry has planned. So you actually have Microsoft, Yahoo, and Amazon.com, for example, lobbying along with the Save the Internet Coalition. Legislation is about to be introduced in the Senate that would protect the future of the Internet, and there are a variety of groups led by a Free Press and Common Cause, among others, that are working on this Save the Internet campaign. So I think right now the public has a real opportunity to get their voices heard, to go to savetheinternet.org, to go to moveon.org or Common Cause, and send a loud message to Congress that it's our Internet and we're not going to let the phone and cable companies do with it as they wish to do.
We've been speaking with Jeff Chester from the Center for Digital Democracy. Find them on the web at democraticmedia.org. Thank you, Jeff Chester, for being with us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
A few years back, it wasn't hard to figure out what was wrong with media coverage of the World Bank and the IMF. With large street protests against those institutions, lazy reporters could skip the serious critiques and focus on the piercings or the hair color of some of the protesters. These days, the protests are smaller, which means the media spends even less time on any of the issues. What they do seem to find most interesting, however, is the fact that former Pentagon official Paul Wolfowitz is now in charge at the World Bank, and for some reporters, a new media frame has emerged, that of a government official humbled by his Iraq war experience, now determined to fight poverty. Joining us now to talk about this is Anne-Louise Colgan. She's the Director of Policy Analysis and Communications at the group Africa Action. Anne-Louise Colgan, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with a typical framing of this issue. There was a story in the New York Times on April 23rd. It was headlined, "At the World Bank, Wolfowitz Works on Improving His Image." The piece began by noting that at the bank's spring meetings, there was just one small protest. The Times took this as a sign of the, quote, surprising lack of controversy surrounding the 10-month tenure of Paul D. Wolfowitz as president of the World Bank, close quote. The paper added that Wolfowitz, quote, has diffused much of the opposition from advocacy groups, close quote. The article didn't include any advocacy groups who might have critical words for the World Bank or Wolfowitz. So are there any critical things to say about Wolfowitz's tenure so far?
Well, there certainly are, and I think what the media has tended to focus on, as you say, is Wolfowitz's drive to fight corruption in Africa and other developing regions. And for groups like Africa Action, it's really important to point out that this is a very one-sided approach to challenging corruption. What we're seeing from the World Bank is this real desire to hold countries in Africa and elsewhere in the developing world accountable for corruption, but then the World Bank is failing to hold itself accountable for its own internal corruption. And so some examples that we're seeing are the World Bank is talking about now delaying the promise of debt relief for some countries in Africa because of concerns of corruption. And we consider that these debts that we're speaking about are illegitimate debts. They are odious debts, and that debt cancellation is really a matter of justice. And these debts should be written off. And what's important is that the World Bank was also responsible for fostering corruption in some of these countries. And we have many examples of this during the Cold War, but one that especially sticks out is in the case of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Mm-hmm. This country was the recipient of most loans from the World Bank and from rich country governments throughout the 70s and into the 80s. It received more loans than any other country in Africa, than all the other countries combined, in fact. even though it was well known that that government was a corrupt dictatorship and that none of that money was going to benefit the people of that country. So the World Bank must itself be held accountable for corruption in its lending practices, and the debts of African countries must be written off as a matter of justice, because it is unjust that they are expected to repay these debts from which the people saw little benefit.
Mm-hmm. If you decide that anti-corruption is going to be your platform, you're bound to get good press out of it, but it does seem like there's been significant public pressure that has forced some of the changes we've seen recently at the World Bank in terms of policy. The problem, I guess, is when you see those kinds of changes reported in the press, it's not about that citizen activism, but it's about kind gestures from the likes of Wolfowitz or other folks at the World Bank. What have citizens been able to accomplish?
Well, absolutely. Corruption is a real concern for civil society in African countries and throughout the Global South, and we've seen in recent years that there are steps being taken on the part of civil society to address this challenge. So we have countries like Uganda that have created a poverty action fund that includes many stakeholders from that country and that ensures that the money freed up as a result of debt relief is used responsibly and is used on social priorities like healthcare and education. And this is an indigenous initiative. It came out of the people of Uganda, and it is something that deserves support. And so this quest for eradication of corruption and this quest for accountability and transparency has to be on both sides. It has to be both on the part of the lender and on the part of the borrower. And what we're seeing instead from Wolfowitz is something that is very one-sided and that targets those countries but accepts no responsibility for the World Bank's own role.
Now, coverage of development and growth in Latin America has changed a bit in the last couple of years, as even the World Bank has come to acknowledge that some of the policies that they've advocated in those countries hasn't led to a significant economic benefit for the population in those countries. What about in Africa? Can folks connect the dots between economic situations and stagnation in countries and perhaps bad advice from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund? Is there that connection?
There absolutely is that connection, and what Africa Action has been highlighting most especially has been the connection between World Bank and IMF policies and the devastating HIV-AIDS crisis in Africa, because what we have discovered from our research is that World Bank and IMF policies have actually undermined healthcare in African countries and have also, as you say, exacerbated poverty and underdevelopment and have therefore led to an even greater health crisis than would already have been. And so what we had pointed out in an action that was held outside the IMF last Friday was the extent to which World Bank and IMF policies have really been hazardous to Africa's health and have damaged Africa's most important resource, which is, in fact, her people. And the conditions that continue to be imposed by the World Bank and IMF now hinder African governments' efforts to respond to this crisis. So it really is an ongoing and devastating impact.
Those would probably be the protests that the New York Times saw as evidence that Wolfowitz was doing a good job in the eyes of the activist community. On a somewhat related note, Africa Action, the group that you represent, recently called out the Washington Post for its recent treatment of the AIDS crisis in Africa. What were you responding to that the Post had done?
The Washington Post had issued an article and an editorial earlier this month that were disputing the accuracy of the UN's estimates of how extensive the HIV/AIDS crisis is in Africa. And what these pieces seemed to do was to minimize the severity of the crisis on the continent, and we really felt that they were very misleading, that they might lead people to think that the urgency of the crisis was somehow less than people had originally thought, when the reality is that the numbers may be slightly less than what were originally projected, but we're talking about at least 20 million people in Africa that are now living with HIV/AIDS, and at least 12 million children in Africa that have lost one or both parents to this disease. And so these countries are still overwhelmed by a health crisis that is almost unprecedented in magnitude, and we felt that these articles lacked that analysis and tended to undermine the severity of the crisis instead of enlightening people as to the realities on the ground.
The Post seemed to be arguing that the statistics were off by a couple of percentage points. It seems sort of baffling to take this on as an issue. Was it connected to some policy that someone's advocating, cutting funds to AIDS prevention or fighting AIDS in Africa, or was it just out of the blue?
It's unclear as to what motivated it, to be honest. I think that the challenges that were faced in the beginning in reporting on the scale of the HIV/AIDS crisis were largely to be expected. I mean, this was a new disease, mm-hmm. and a lot of these countries do not have very sophisticated reporting systems or capacities. But the revisions, as I said, and as you pointed out, are actually quite small, and so they really do not raise any questions as to the seriousness of this crisis. And so we felt that it was irresponsible, in fact, of the Washington Post to have written articles that were framed in this way, and that this kind of scrutiny was actually unwelcome and unhelpful.
We've been speaking with Anne Louise Colgan. She's the Director of Policy Analysis and Communications at the group Africa Action. You can find them online at www.africaaction.org. Anne Louise Colgan, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
This is Independent Native News for Friday, the 28th of April. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. In Houston this week, indigenous leaders living in Ecuador's Amazon rainforest, along with human rights groups, converged on Chevron's annual shareholders meeting to talk about concerns over toxic dumping. KPFT's Jack Batiste reports.
It's called the Rainforest Chernobyl by local residents. They came to meet with CEO David O'Reilly about the company's dumping, which they say is 30 times worse than the Exxon Valdez spill. The group wants shareholders to know about a potential multi-billion dollar liability.
Texaco,
which was bought by Chevron in 2001, admits that it dumped billions of gallons of toxic water of formation into Ecuador's rainforest from 1964 to 1992. The indigenous Kofan Nation say that their battle with O'Reilly and Chevron is personal, and that they, the Kofan, are dying. From Houston, I'm Jack Batiste.
Native high school students from interior Alaska are building their own computers from the motherboard up. As INN's Robert Hannon reports, the project seeks to increase the number of Alaska Natives entering the sciences and engineering, where their numbers lag behind other ethnic groups.
Sasha Dixon has an engineering degree from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Her family originally came from the village of Wales on the tip of Alaska's Seward Peninsula. She says she always wanted to share her passion for science with others. Now with the ANSEP, or Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, she can do just that.
We hand out all of the pieces and parts, from the case to the keyboard to the hard drive, the DVD drive, everything that's needed to have a functional computer. And the students put it all together and make it run, and they actually install the operating system. It's very empowering.
Dixon says the students get to keep the computers and receive a $500 college scholarship, but only if they take trigonometry, chemistry, and physics in high school and earn a C or better. The program is funded by the National Science Foundation and industry grants. That agreement attracted Athabascan Jed Dementev. He says he and his mom were on the lookout for scholarship programs when they heard about ANSEP.
At first, it was kind of overwhelming. I mean, if you just mess up one spot somewhere, then it won't work. And I actually did that. I didn't plug in the right cord into the, you know, the motherboard, and my computer wouldn't turn on. So we had to open it back up, rearrange some wires, and then it worked fine.
Dementev says before the ANSEP program, he hadn't really considered the sciences as a career path. But now he says he looks around and sees how increasingly technological the world is becoming, and he wants to be a part of it. Administrators say the program is seeing a 90% student retention rate. For INN, I'm Robert Hannon.
In South Dakota, a public forum honoring the memory and legacy of Vine Deloria Jr. takes place this Sunday at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology campus. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Francis Lynn has details.
Bridges for Intercultural Understanding is sponsoring a forum entitled Vine Deloria Jr. and the Great Mystery to honor the legacy of the late Dakota scholar. Professor of American Indian Cultures and Traditions Tink Tinker says Deloria's works will be read for generations.
there is no greater published intellect in the American Indian world. He changed the way Indian people thought about themselves in terms of how we have adjusted to the colonial realities of conquest.
Tinker, who will be speaking at the event, hopes forums like these will help break down the walls of racism in South Dakota. The presentation is part of an ongoing series dedicated to the late author and activist. Vine Deloria Jr. published more than 20 works, including Custer Died for Your Sins and Red Earth, White Lies. He passed away last November at the age of 72. I'm Frances Lynn in Rapid City.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a native venture protecting Indian country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska.